Side 10, It, by Stephen King, continuing on page 344. Richie wiped the egg off his chin. $3 if I have it all done when you get home tonight? He asked the newspaper. His father's eyes appeared again briefly.
$2.50.
Oh, man, Richie said. You and Jack Benny.
My idol, Wendt said from behind the paper.
Make up your mind, Richie. I want to read these box scores.
Deal, Richie said, and sighed.
When your folks had you by the balls, they really knew how to squeeze.
It was pretty chuckalicious when you thought it over.
As he mowed, he practiced his voices. 7. He finished front, back, and sides by 3 o'clock Friday afternoon and began Saturday with $2.50 in his jeans. Pretty damn near a fortune. He called Bill up, but Bill told him glumly that he had to go up to Bangor and take some kind of speech therapy test. Richie sympathized and then added in his best stuttering Bill voice,
Give him help, big Bill. You're facing my butt to the tozier,
Bill said and hung up. He called Eddie Kasprach next, but Eddie sounded even more depressed than Bill. His mother had gotten them each a full-day bus pass, he said, and they were going to visit Eddie's aunts in Haven and Bangor and Hamden. All three of them were fat, like Mrs. Kasprach, and all three of them were single.
They'll all pinch my cheek and tell me how much I've grown, Eddie said.
That's 'cause they know how cute you are, Eds, just like me. I saw what a cutie you were the first time I met you.
Sometimes you're really a turd, Richie.
It takes one to know one, Eds, and you know 'em all. You gonna be down in the Barrens next week?
I guess so, if you guys are. Want to play guns?
Maybe, but I think me and Big Bill have got something to tell you.
What?
It's really Bill's story, I guess. I'll see you. Enjoy your aunts.
Very funny.
His third call was to Stan the man, but Stan was in Dutch with his folks for breaking their picture window. He had been playing flying saucer with a pie plate, and it took a bad bank. Key rash. He had to do chores all weekend, and probably next weekend, too. Richie commiserated, and then asked Stan if he would be coming down to the Barrens next week. Stan said he guessed so, if his father didn't decide to ground him or something.
Gee, Stan, it was just a window, Richie said.
Yeah, but a big one, Stan said, and hung up.
Richie started to leave the living room, then thought of Ben Hanscom. He thumbed through the telephone book and found a listing for an Arlene Hanscom. Since she was the only lady Hanscom among the four listed, Richie figured it had to be Ben's number and called.
I'd like to go, but I already spent my allowance, Ben said.
He sounded depressed and ashamed by the admission. He had, in fact, spent it all on candy, soda, chips, and beef jerky strips. Richie, who was rolling in dough, and who didn't like to go to the movies alone, said,
I got plenty of money. You can give me Ozies.
Yeah? Really? You do that?
Sure,
Richie said, puzzled. Why not?
Okay, Ben said happily. Okay, that'd be great. Two horror movies. Did you say one was a werewolf picture?
Yeah.
Man, I love werewolf pictures.
Geez, Haystack, don't wet your pants.
Ben laughed. I'll see you out in front of the Aladdin, okay?
Yeah, great.
Richie hung up and looked at the phone thoughtfully. It suddenly occurred to him that Ben Hanscom was lonely, and that in turn made him feel rather heroic. He was whistling as he ran upstairs to get some comics to read before the show. 8. The day was sunny, breezy, and cool. Richie jived along Center Street toward the Aladdin, popping his fingers and singing Rockin' Robin under his breath. He was feeling good. Going to the movies always made him feel good. He loved that magic world, those magic dreams. He felt sorry for anyone who had dull duties to discharge on such a day. Bill with his speech therapy, Eddie with his aunts, poor old Stan the man who would be spending the afternoon scraping down the front porch steps or sweeping the garage because the pie plate he'd been throwing around swept right when it was supposed to sweep left. Richie had his yo-yo tucked in his back pocket, and now he took it out and tried again to get it to sleep.
This was an ability Richie lusted to acquire, but so far, no soap. The crazy little fucker just wouldn't do it. Either it went down and popped right back up, or it went down and dropped dead at the end of its string. Halfway up Center Street Hill, he saw a girl in a beige pleated skirt and a white sleeveless blouse sitting on a bench outside Shook's drugstore. She was eating what looked like a pistachio ice cream cone. Bright red auburn hair, its highlights seeming coppery, or sometimes almost blonde, hung down to her shoulder blades. Richie knew only one girl with hair of that particular shade. It was Beverly Marsh. Richie liked Bev a lot. Well, he liked her, but not that way. He admired her looks, and he knew he wasn't alone. Girls like Sally Mueller and Greta Bowie hated Beverly like fire, still too young to understand how they could have everything else so easily and still have to compete in the matter of looks with a girl who lived in one of those slummy apartments on Lower Main Street. But mostly he liked her because she was tough and had a really good sense of humor. Also, she usually had cigarettes. He liked her, in short, because she was a good guy. Still, he had once or twice caught himself wondering what color underwear she was wearing under her small selection of rather faded skirts, and that was not the sort of thing you wondered about the other guys, was it? And, Richie had to admit, she was one hell of a pretty guy. Approaching the bench where she sat eating her ice cream, Richie belted an invisible top coat around his middle, pulled down an invisible slouch hat, and pretended to be Humphrey Bogart. Adding the correct voice, he became Humphrey Bogart. At least to himself. To others, he would have sounded like Richie Tozier with a mild head cold. "Hello, sweetheart," he said, gliding up to the bench where she was sitting and looking out at the traffic. "No sense waiting for a bus here. The Nazis have cut off our retreat. The last plane leaves at midnight. You be on it. He needs you, sweetheart. So do I. But I'll get along somehow." "Hi, Richie," Bev said, and when she turned toward him, he saw a purple blackish bruise on her right cheek, like the shadow of a crow's wing. He was again struck by her good looks, only it occurred to him now that she might actually be beautiful. It had never really occurred to him until that moment that there might be beautiful girls outside of the movies, or that he himself might know one. Perhaps it was the bruise that allowed him to see the possibility of her beauty. An essential contrast, a particular flaw which first drew attention to itself and then somehow defined the rest. The gray-blue eyes, the naturally red lips, the creamy, unblemished child skin. There was a tiny spray of freckles across her nose. "See anything green?" she asked, tossing her head pertly. "You, sweetheart," Richie said. "You've turned green ash Limburger cheese. But when we get you out of Casablanca, you're going into the finest hospital money can buy. We'll turn you white again. I swear it, on my mother's name." "You're an asshole, Richie. That doesn't sound like Humphrey Bogart at all." But she smiled a little as she said it. Richie sat down next to her. "You going to the movies?" "I don't have any money," she said. "Can I see your yo-yo?" He handed it over. "I ought to take it back," he told her. "It's supposed to sleep, but it doesn't. I got chapped." She poked her finger through the loop of string, and Richie pushed his glasses up on the bridge of his nose so he could watch what she was doing better. She turned her hand over, palm toward the sky, the Duncan yo-yo tucked neatly into the valley of flesh formed by her cupped hand. She rolled the yo-yo off her index finger. It went down to the end of its string and fell asleep. When she twitched her fingers in a come-on gesture, it promptly woke up and climbed its string to her palm again. "Oh, bug dung, look at that," Richie said. "That's kid stuff," Bev said. "Watch this." She snapped the yo-yo down again. She let it sleep for a moment and then walked the dog with it in a smart series of snap jerks up the string to her hand again. "Oh, stop it," Richie said. "I hate show-offs." "Or how about this?" Bev asked, smiling sweetly. She got the yo-yo going back in front, making the red wooden Duncan look like a bolo bouncer Richie had had once. She finished with two around-the-worlds, almost hitting a shuffling old lady who glared at them. The yo-yo ended up in her cupped palm, its string neatly rolled around its spindle. Bev handed it back to Richie and sat down on the bench again.
Richie sat down next to her, his jaw hanging agape in perfectly unaffected admiration. Bev looked at him and giggled.
Shut your mouth, you're drawing flies.
Richie shut his mouth with a snap. Besides, that last part was just luck. First time in my life I did two around the worlds in a row without fizzing out. Kids were walking past them now on their way to the show. Peter Gordon walked by with Marcia Fadden. They were supposed to be going together, but Richie figured it was just that they lived next door to each other on West Broadway and were such a couple of assholes that they needed each other's support and attention. Peter Gordon was already getting a pretty good crop of acne, although he was only 12. He sometimes hung around with Bowers, Chris, and Huggins, but he wasn't quite brave enough to try anything on his own. He glanced over at Richie and Bev sitting together on the bench and chanted,
Richie and Beverly up in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage. And here comes Richie with the baby carriage,
Marcia finished, cawing laughter.
Sit on this, dear heart, Bev said, and whipped the finger on them.
Marcia looked away, disgusted, as if she could not believe anyone could be so uncouth. Gordon slipped an arm around her and called back over his shoulder to Richie,
Maybe I'll see you later, Four Eyes.
Maybe you'll see your mother's girdle, Richie responded smartly, if a little senselessly. Beverly collapsed with laughter. She leaned against Richie's shoulder for a moment, and Richie had just time to reflect that her touch and the sensation of her lightly carried weight was not exactly unpleasant. Then she sat up again.
What a pair of jerks, she said.
Yeah, I think Marcia Fadden pees rose water, Richie said, and Beverly got the giggles again.
Chanel number 5, she said, her voice muffled because her hands were over her mouth.
You bet, said Richie, although he hadn't the slightest idea what Chanel number 5 was.
Bev?
What?
Can you show me how to make it sleep?
I guess so. I never tried to show anyone.
How did you learn? Who showed you?
She gave him a disgusted look.
No one showed me. I just figured it out. Like twirling a baton. I'm great at that.
No conceit in your family, Richie said, rolling his eyes.
Well, I am, she said. But I didn't take classes or anything.
You really can twirl?
Sure.
Probably be a cheerleader in junior high, huh?
She smiled. It was a kind of smile Richie had never seen before.
It was wise, cynical, and sad all at the same time. He recoiled a little from its unknowing power, as he had recoiled from the picture of downtown in Georgie's album when it had begun to move.
That's for girls like Marcia Fadden, she said. Her and Sally Mueller and Greta Bowie. Girls who pee rosewater. Their fathers helped to buy the sports equipment and the uniforms. They got an in. I'll never be a cheerleader.
Geez, Bev, that's no attitude to take.
Sure it is, if it's the truth.
She shrugged. I don't care. Who wants to do somersaults and show your underwear to a million people anyway?
Look, Richie, watch this.
For the next 10 minutes, she worked on showing Richie how to make his yo-yo sleep. Near the end, Richie actually began to get the hang of it, although he could usually only get it to come halfway up the string after waking it up.
You're not jerking your fingers hard enough, that's all, she said.
Richie looked at the clock on the Merrill Trust across the street and jumped up, stuffing his yo-yo into his back pocket.
Jeepers, I gotta get going, Bev. I'm supposed to meet old Haystack. He'll think I changed my mind or something.
Who's Haystack?
Oh, Ben Hanscom. I call him Haystack, though. You know, like Haystack Calhoun, the wrestler.
Bev frowned at him.
That's not very nice. I like Ben.
Don't whoop me, massa,
Richie screeched in his pickaninny voice, rolling his eyes and flapping his hands.
Don't whoop me. I's gwine ter be a good docky, ma'am. I's...
Richie, Bev said thinly.
Richie quit it.
I like him, too, he said. We all built the dam down in the Barrens a couple of days ago, and...
You go down there? You and Ben play down there?
Sure, a bunch of us guys do. It's sort of cool down there.
Richie glanced at the clock again. I really got a split for the scene. Ben'll be waiting.
Okay.
He paused, thought, and said, If you're not doing anything, come on with me.
I told you, I don't have any money.
I'll pay your way. I got a couple of bucks. She tossed the remains of her ice cream cone in a nearby litter barrel. Her eyes, that fine clear shade of blue-gray, turned up to his. They were coolly amused. She pretended to primp her hair and asked him, "Oh dear, am I being asked out on a date?" For a moment, Richie was uncharacteristically flustered. He actually felt a blush rising in his cheeks. He had made the offer in a perfectly natural way, just as he had made it to Ben. Except hadn't he said something to Ben about Ozies? Yes, but he hadn't said anything about Ozies to Beverly. Richie suddenly felt a bit weird. He had dropped his eyes, retreating from her amused glance, and realized now that her skirt had ridden up a bit when she shifted forward to drop the ice cream cone in the litter barrel, and he could see her knees. He raised his eyes, but that was no help. Now he was looking at the beginning swells of her bosoms. Richie, as he usually did in such moments of confusion, took refuge in absurdity. "Yes, a date," he screamed, throwing himself on his knees before her and holding his clasped hands up. "Please come, please come. I shall ruddy kill myself if you say no, eh? What, what, what?" "Oh, Richie, you're such a fuzzbrain," she said, giggling again. But weren't her cheeks also a trifle flushed? If so, it made her look prettier than ever. "Get up before you get arrested." He got up and plopped down beside her again. He felt as if his equilibrium had returned. A little foolishness always helped when you had a dizzy spell, he believed. "You want to go?" "Sure," she said. "Thank you very much. Think of it, my first date. Just wait until I write it in my diary tonight." She clasped her hands together between her budding breasts, fluttered her eyelashes rapidly, and then laughed. "I wish you'd stop calling it that," Richie said. She sighed. "You don't have much romance in your soul." "Damn right I don't." But he felt somehow delighted with himself. The world seemed suddenly very clear to him and very friendly. He found himself glancing sideways at her from time to time. She was looking in the shop windows at the dresses and nightgowns in Cornell Hopley's, at the towels and pots in the window of the discount barn, and he stole glances at her hair, the line of her jaw. He observed the way her bare arms came out of the round holes of her blouse. He saw the edge of her slip strap. All of these things delighted him. He could not have said why, but what had happened in George Denbrough's bedroom had never seemed more distant to him than it did right then. It was time to go, time to meet Ben, but he would sit here just a moment longer while her eyes window shopped, because it was good to look at her and be with her. 9. Kids were ponying up their quarter admissions at the Aladdin's box office window and going into the lobby. Looking through the bank of glass doors, Richie could see a crowd around the candy counter. The popcorn machine was in overdrive, spilling out drifts of the stuff, its greasy, hinged lid jittering up and down. He didn't see Ben anywhere. He asked Beverly if she had spotted him. She shook her head. "Maybe he already went in. He said he didn't have any money. And the daughter of Frankenstein there would never let him in without a ticket." Richie cocked a thumb at Mrs. Cole, who had been the ticket taker at the Aladdin since a time well before the pictures had begun to talk. Her hair, dyed a bright red, was so thin you could see her scalp beneath. She had enormous hanging lips, which she painted with plum-colored lipstick. Wild blotches of rouge covered her cheeks. Her eyebrows were drawn on in black pencil. Mrs. Cole was a perfect Democrat. She hated all kids equally. "Boy, I don't want to go in without him, but the show's going to start," Richie said. "Where in heck is he?" "You can buy him a ticket and leave it at the box office," Bev said, reasonably enough. "Then when he comes..." But just then Ben came around the corner of Center and Macklin Streets. He was puffing, and his belly joggled beneath his sweatshirt. He saw Richie and raised one hand to wave. Then he saw Bev, and his hand stopped in mid-flap. His eyes widened momentarily. He finished his wave and then walked slowly to where they stood under the Aladdin's marquee. "Hi, Richie," he said, and then looked at Bev briefly. It was as if he was afraid that an overlong look might result in a flash burn. "Hi, Bev." "Hello, Ben," she said, and a strange silence fell between the two of them. It was not precisely awkward. It was, Richie thought, almost powerful. And he felt a vague twinge of jealousy because something had passed between them, and whatever it had been, he had been excluded from it. "Howdy, Haystack," he said. "Thought you went chicken on me. These movies gon' scare 10 pounds off your pudgy body. I say they gon' turn your hair white, boy. When you come out this theater, you gon' need an usher to help you up the aisle. You gon' be shaking so bad." Richie started for the box office, and Ben touched his arm. Ben started to speak, glanced at Bev, who was smiling at him, and had to start over again.
"I was here," he said, "but I went up the street and around the corner when those guys came along."
"What guys?" Richie asked, but he thought he already knew.
"Henry Bowers, Victor Chris, Belch Huggins, some other guys, too."
Richie whistled.
"They must have already gone inside the theater. I don't see them buying candy."
"Yeah, I guess so."
"If I was them, I wouldn't bother paying to see a couple of horror movies," Richie said. "I'd just stay home and look in the mirror, save some bread."
Bev laughed merrily at that, but Ben only smiled a little. Henry Bowers had maybe only started out to hurt him that day last week, but he had ended up meaning to kill him. Ben was quite sure of that.
"Tell you what," Richie said, "we'll go up in the balcony. They'll all be sitting down in the second or third row with their feet up."
"You positive?" Ben asked.
He was not at all sure Richie understood what bad news those kids were. Henry, of course, being the worst news of all. Richie, who had barely escaped what might have been a really bad beating at the hands of Henry and his spasmoid friends 3 months ago, he had managed to elude them in the toy department of Freese's department store, of all places, understood more about Henry and his merry crew than Ben thought he did.
"If I wasn't fairly positive, I wouldn't go in," he said. "I want to see those movies, Haystack, but I don't want to, like, die for 'em.
Besides, if they give us any trouble, we'll just tell Foxy to kick them out," Bev said.
Foxy was Mr. Foxworth, the thin, sallow, glum-looking man who managed the Aladdin. He was now selling candy and popcorn, chanting his litany of, "Wait your turn, wait your turn, wait your turn." In his threadbare tux and yellowing boiled shirt, he looked like an undertaker who had fallen on hard times. Ben looked doubtfully from Bev to Foxy to Richie.
"You can't let him run your life, man," Richie said softly. "Don't you know that?"
"I guess so," Ben said and sighed. Actually, he knew no such thing. But Beverly's being here had given the equation a crazy skew. If she hadn't come, he would have tried to persuade Richie to go to the movies another day. And if Richie had persisted, Ben might have bowed out. But Bev was here. He didn't want to look like a chicken in front of her. And the thought of being with her, in the balcony, in the dark, even if Richie was between them, as he probably would be, was a powerful attraction.
"We'll wait until the show starts before we go in," Richie said.
He grinned and punched Ben on the arm.
"Shit, Haystack, you want to live forever?"
Ben's brows drew together, and then he snorted laughter. Richie also laughed. Looking at them, Beverly laughed too. Richie approached the ticket booth again. Liverlips Cole looked at him sourly.
"Good afternoon, dear lady,"
Richie said in his best barren butthole voice.
"I am in dire need of 3 ticky-tickies to your dear old American flick tunes." "Cut the crap and tell me what you want, kid,"
Liverlips barked through the round hole cut in the glass, and something about the way her painted eyebrows were going up and down unsettled Richie so much that he simply pushed a rumpled dollar through the slot and muttered, "3, please." 3 tickets popped out of the slot. Richie took them. Liverlips rammed a quarter back at him.
"Don't be smart. Don't throw popcorn boxes. Don't holler. Don't run in the lobby. Don't run in the aisles."
"No, ma'am," Richie said, backing away to where Ben and Bev stood. He said to them, "It always warms my heart to see an old fart like that who really likes kids."
They stood outside a while longer, waiting for the show to start. Liverlips glared at them suspiciously from her glass cage. Richie regaled Bev with the story of the dam and the barons, trumpeting Mr. Nell's lines in his new Irish cop voice. Beverly was giggling before long, laughing hard not long after that. Even Ben was grinning a little, although his eyes kept shifting either toward the Aladdin's glass doors or to Beverly's face. 10. The balcony was okay. During the first reel of I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, Richie spotted Henry Bowers and his shit-kicking friends. They were down in the second row, just as he had figured they would be. There were 5 or 6 of them in all. 5th, 6th, and 7th graders, all of them with their motor huckle boots cocked up on the seats in front of them. Foxy would come down and tell them to put their feet on the floor. They would. Foxy would leave. Up went the motor huckle boots again as soon as he did. 5 or 10 minutes later, Foxy would return and the entire charade would be acted out again. Foxy didn't quite have the guts to kick them out and they knew it. The movies were great.
The teenage Frankenstein was suitably gross. The teenage werewolf was somehow scarier, though perhaps because he also seemed a little sad. What had happened wasn't his own fault. There was this hypnotist who had fucked him up, but the only reason he'd been able to was that the kid who turned into the werewolf was full of anger and bad feelings. Richie found himself wondering if there were many people in the world hiding bad feelings like that. Henry Bowers was just overflowing with bad feelings, but he sure didn't bother hiding them. Beverly sat between the boys, ate popcorn from their boxes, screamed, covered her eyes, sometimes laughed. When the werewolf was stalking the girl doing exercises in the gym after school, she pressed her face against Ben's arm, and Richie heard Ben's gasp of surprise even over the screams of the 200 kids below them. The werewolf was finally killed. In the last scene, one cop solemnly told another that this should teach people not to fiddle with things best left to God. The curtain came down and the lights came up. There was applause. Richie felt totally satisfied, if a little headachy. He'd probably have to go to the eye doctor pretty soon and get his lenses changed again. He really would be wearing Coke bottles on his eyes by the time he got to high school, he thought glumly. Ben twitched at his sleeve. "They saw us, Richie," he said in a dry, dismayed voice. "Huh?" "Bowers and Chris. They looked up here on their way out. They saw us." "Okay, okay," Richie said. "Calm down, Haystack. Just calm down. We'll go out the side door. Nothing to worry about." They went down the stairs, Richie in the lead, Beverly in the middle, Ben bringing up the rear and looking back over his shoulder every two steps or so. "Have those guys really got it in for you, Ben?" Beverly asked. "Yeah, I guess they do," Ben said. "I got in a fight with Henry Bowers on the last day of school." "Did he beat you up?" "Not as much as he wanted to," Ben said. "That's why he's still mad, I guess." "Old Hank the Tank also lost a fair amount of skin," Richie murmured. "Or so I heard. I don't think he was very pleased about that either." He pushed open the exit door and the three of them stepped out into the alley that ran between the Aladdin and Nan's luncheonette. A cat which had been rooting in a garbage can hissed and ran past them down the alley, which was blocked at the far end by a board fence. The cat scrambled up and over. A trash can lid clattered. Bev jumped, grabbed Richie's arm, and then laughed nervously. "I guess I'm still scared from the movies," she said. "You won't," Richie began. "Hello, fuckface," Henry Bowers said from behind them. Startled, the three of them turned around. Henry, Victor, and Belch were standing at the mouth of the alley. There were two other guys behind them. "Oh, shit. I knew this was going to happen," Ben moaned. Richie turned quickly back toward the Aladdin, but the exit door had closed behind them, and there was no way to open it from the outside. "Say goodbye, fuckface," Henry said, and suddenly ran at Ben. The things that happened next seemed to Richie both then and later like something out of a movie. Such things simply did not happen in real life. In real life, the little kids took their beatings, picked up their teeth, and went home. It didn't happen that way this time. Beverly stepped forward and to one side, almost as if she intended to meet Henry, perhaps shake his hand. Richie could hear the cleats of his boots rapping. Victor and Belch were coming after him. The other two boys stood at the mouth of the alley, guarding it. "Leave him alone," Beverly shouted. "Pick on someone your own size." "He's as big as a fucking Mack truck, bitch," Henry, no gentleman, snarled. "Now get out of my..." Richie stuck out his foot. He didn't think he meant to. His foot went out the same way wisecracks, dangerous to his health, sometimes emerged, all on their own, from his mouth. Henry ran into it and fell forward. The brick surface of the alley was slippery with spilled garbage from the overflowing cans on the luncheonette side. Henry went skidding like a shuffleboard weight. He started to get up, his shirt blotched with coffee grounds, mud, and bits of lettuce. "Oh, you guys are gonna die," he screamed. Until this moment, Ben had been terrified. Now something in him snapped. He let out a roar and grabbed one of the garbage cans. For just a moment, holding it up, garbage spilling everywhere, he really did look like Haystack Calhoun. His face was pale and furious. He threw the garbage can. It struck Henry in the small of the back and knocked him flat again. "Let's get out of here," Richie screamed. They ran toward the mouth of the alley. Victor Chris jumped in front of them. Bellowing, Ben lowered his head and rammed it into Victor's middle. Woof! Victor grunted and sat down. Belch grabbed a handful of Beverly's ponytail and whipped her smartly against the Aladdin's brick wall. Beverly bounced off and ran down the alley, rubbing her arm. Richie ran after her, grabbing a garbage can lid on the way. Belch Huggins swung a fist almost the size of a daisy ham at him. Richie pistoned out the galvanized steel lid. Belch's fist met it. There was a loud bong, a sound that was almost mellow. Richie felt the shock travel all the way up his arm to the shoulder. Belch screamed and began to hop up and down, holding his swelling hand.
"Yonder lies the tent of my father,"
Richie said confidentially, doing a very passable Tony Curtis voice, and then ran after Ben and Beverly. One of the boys at the mouth of the alley had caught Beverly. Ben was tussling with him. The other boy began to rabbit punch Ben in the small of the back. Richie swung his foot. It connected with the rabbit puncher's buttocks. The boy howled with pain. Richie grabbed Beverly's arm in one hand, Ben's in the other.
"Run!" he shouted.
The boy Ben had been tussling with let go of Beverly and looped a punch at Richie. His ear exploded with momentary pain, then went numb and became very warm. A high whistling sound began to whine in his head. It sounded like the noise you were supposed to listen for when the school nurse put the earphones on you to test your hearing. They ran down Center Street. People turned to look at them. Ben's large stomach pogoed up and down. Beverly's ponytail bounced. Richie let go of Ben and held his glasses against his forehead with his left thumb so he wouldn't lose them. His head was still ringing, and he believed his ear was going to swell, but he felt wonderful. He started laughing. Beverly joined him. Soon Ben was laughing, too. They cut up Court Street and collapsed on a bench in front of the police station. At that moment, it seemed the only place in Derry where they might possibly be safe. Beverly looped an arm around Ben's neck and Richie's. She gave them a furious hug.
"That was great."
Her eyes sparkled. "Did you see those guys? Did you see them?"
"I saw them all right," Ben gasped, "and I never want to see them again."
This sent them off into another storm of hysterical laughter. Richie kept expecting Henry's gang to come around the corner onto Court Street and take after them again, police station or not. Still, he could not stop laughing. Beverly was right. It had been great.
"The Losers Club gets off a good one," Richie yelled exuberantly. "Wacka, wacka, wacka."
He cupped his hands around his mouth and put on his Ben Burney voice. "Yowza, yowza, yowza, children's." A cop poked his head out of an open second floor window and shouted, "You kids get out of here, right now. Take a walk." Richie opened his mouth to say something brilliant, quite possibly in his brand new Irish cop voice, and Ben kicked his foot.
"Shut up, Richie," he said,
and promptly had trouble believing that he had said such a thing.
"Right, Richie," Bev said, looking at him fondly.
"Beep, beep."
"Okay," Richie said. "What do you guys want to do? Want to go find Henry Bowers and ask him if he wants to work it out over a game of Monopoly?"
"Bite your tongue," Bev said.
"Huh? What does that mean?"
"Never mind," Bev said. "Some guys are so ignorant."
Hesitantly, blushing furiously, Ben asked,
"Did that guy hurt your hair, Beverly?"
She smiled at him gently, and in that moment she became sure of something she had only guessed at before, that it had been Ben Hanscom who had sent her the postcard with the beautiful little haiku on it.
"No, it wasn't bad," she said.
"Let's go down in the Barrens," Richie proposed.
And so that was where they went, or where they escaped. Richie would think later that it set a pattern for the rest of the summer. The Barrens had become their place. Beverly, like Ben on the day of his first encounter with the big boys, had never been down there before. She walked between Richie and Ben as the three of them moved single file down the path. Her skirt twitched prettily, and looking at her, Ben was aware of waves of feeling, as powerful as stomach cramps. She was wearing her ankle bracelet. It flashed in the afternoon sun. They crossed the arm of the Kenduskeag the boys had dammed up. The stream divided about 70 yards farther up along its course and became one again about 200 yards farther on toward town. Using stepping stones downstream of the place where the dam had been, found another path and eventually came out on the bank of the stream's eastern fork, which was much wider than the other. It sparkled in the afternoon light. To his left, Ben could see two of those concrete cylinders with the manhole covers on top. Below them, jutting out over the stream, were large concrete pipes. Thin streams of muddy water poured over the lips of these outflow pipes and into the Kenduskeag.
Somebody takes a crap uptown, and here's where it comes out, Ben thought, remembering Mr. Nell's explanation of Derry's drainage system. He felt a dull sort of helpless anger. Once there had probably been fish in this river. Now your chances of catching a trout wouldn't be so hot. Your chances of catching a used wad of toilet paper would be better.
It's so beautiful here, Bev sighed.
Yeah, not bad, Richie agreed. The black flies are gone, and there's enough of a breeze to keep the mosquitoes away. He looked at her hopefully.
Got any cigarettes?
No, she said. I had a couple, but I smoked them yesterday.
Too bad, Richie said.
There was the blast of an air horn, and they all watched as a long freight rumbled across the embankment on the far side of the barrens and toward the train yards.
Geez, if it was a passenger train, they'd have a great view, Richie thought. First the poor folks' houses of the Old Cape, then the bamboo swamps on the other side of the Kanduskeag, and finally, before leaving the barrens, the smoldering gravel pit that was the town dump. For just a moment, he found himself thinking about Eddie's story again. The leper under the abandoned house on Niebolt Street. He pushed it out of his mind and turned to Ben.
So what was your best part, Haystack?
Huh? Ben turned to him guiltily. As Bev looked out across the Kanduskeag, lost in thoughts of her own, he had been looking at her profile and at the bruise on her cheekbone.
Of the movies, Dumbo, what was your best part?
I liked it when Dr. Frankenstein started tossing the bodies to the crocodiles under the house, Ben said. That was my best part.
That was gross, Beverly said and shivered.
I hate things like that. Crocodiles and piranhas and sharks.
Yeah? What's piranhas? Richie asked, immediately interested.
Little tiny fish, Beverly said. And they've got all these little tiny teeth, but they're wicked sharp. And if you go into a river where they are, they eat you right down to the bone.
Wow!
I saw this movie once, and these natives wanted to cross a river, but the footbridge was down, she said. So they put a cow in the water on a rope and crossed while the piranhas were eating the cow. When they pulled it out, the cow was nothing but a skeleton. I had nightmares for a week.
Man, I wish I had some of those fish, Richie said happily. I'd put them in Henry Bauer's bathtub.
Ben began to giggle.
I don't think he takes baths.
I don't know about that, but I do know we better watch out for those guys, Beverly said.
Her fingers touched the bruise on her cheek.
My dad went up the side of my head day before yesterday for breaking a pile of dishes. One a week is enough.
There was a moment of silence that might have been awkward, but was not. Richie broke it by saying his best part was when the teenage werewolf got the evil hypnotist. They talked about the movies and other horror movies they had seen and Alfred Hitchcock Presents on TV for an hour or more. Bev spotted daisies growing on the riverbank and picked one. She held it first under Richie's chin and then under Ben's chin to see if they liked butter. She said they both did. As she held the flower under their chins, each was conscious of her light touch on their shoulders and the clean scent of her hair. Her face was close to Ben's only for a moment or two, but that night he dreamed of how her eyes had looked during that brief, endless span of time. Conversation was fading a little when they heard the crackling sounds of people approaching along the path. The three of them turned quickly toward the sound, and Richie was suddenly acutely aware that the river was at their backs. There was no place to run. The voices drew closer. They got to their feet, Richie and Ben moving a little in front of Beverly without even thinking about it. The screen of bushes at the end of the path shook, and suddenly Bill Denbro emerged. Another kid was with him, a fellow Richie knew a little bit. His name was Bradley something, and he had a terrible lisp. Probably went up to Bangor with Bill for that speech therapy thing, Richie thought.
Big Bill, he said, and then in the voice of Toodles, we are glad to see you, Mr. Denbro Moster.
Bill looked at them and grinned, and a peculiar certainty stole over Richie as Bill looked from him to Ben to Beverly, and then back to Bradley, whatever his name was. Beverly was a part of them. Bill's eyes said so. Bradley, what's his name, was not. He might stay for a while today, might even come down to the Barrens again. No one would tell him no, so sorry, the Losers Club membership is full, we already have our speech impediment member. But he was not part of it. He was not part of them. This thought led to a sudden irrational fear. For a moment he felt the way you did when you suddenly realized you had swum out too far and the water was over your head. There was an intuitive flash. We're being drawn into something, being picked and chosen. None of this is accidental.
Are we all here yet? Then the intuition fell into a meaningless jumble of thought, like the smash of a glass pane on a stone floor. Besides, it didn't matter. Bill was here, and Bill would take care. Bill would not let things get out of control. He was the tallest of them, and surely the most handsome. Richie only had to look sideways at Bev's eyes, fixed on Bill, and then farther to Ben's eyes, fixed knowingly and unhappily on Bev's face, to know that. Bill was also the strongest of them, and not just physically. There was a good deal more to it than that, but since Richie did not know either the word charisma or the full meaning of the word magnetism, he only felt that Bill's strength ran deep and might manifest itself in many ways, some of them probably unexpected. And Richie suspected if Beverly fell for him or got a crush on him or whatever they called it, Ben would not be jealous, like he would, Richie thought, if she got a crush on me. He would accept it as nothing but natural. And there was something else. Bill was good. It was stupid to think such a thing. He did not, in fact, precisely think it. He felt it. But there it was. Goodness and strength seemed to radiate from Bill. He was like a knight in an old movie, a movie that was corny but still had the power to make you cry and cheer and clap at the end. Strong and good. And 5 years later, after his memories of what had happened in Derry both during and before that summer had begun to fade rapidly, it occurred to Richie Tozier in his mid-teens that John Kennedy reminded him of Stuttering Bill. Who? His mind would respond. He would look up, faintly puzzled, and shake his head. Some guy I used to know, he would think, and would dismiss vague unease by pushing his glasses up on his nose and turning to his homework again. Some guy I used to know a long time ago. Bill Dendro put his hands on his hips, smiled sunnily, and said, Well, here we are. Now, what are we doing? Got any cigarettes? Richie asked hopefully. 11. 5 days later, as June drew toward its end, Bill told Richie that he wanted to go down to Niebold Street and investigate under the porch where Eddie had seen the leper. They had just arrived back at Richie's house, and Bill was walking Silver. He had ridden Richie double most of the way home, an exhilarating speed trip across Derry, but he had been careful to let Richie dismount a block away from his house. If Richie's mother saw Bill riding Richie double, she'd have a bird. Silver's wire basket was full of play six-shooters, two of them Bill's, three of them Richie's. They had been down in the Barrens for most of the afternoon playing guns. Beverly Marsh had shown up around 3 o'clock, wearing faded jeans and toting a very old Daisy air rifle that had lost most of its pop. When you pulled its tape-wrapped trigger, it uttered a wheeze that sounded to Richie more like someone sitting on a very old whoopee cushion than a rifle shot. Her specialty was Japanese sniper. She was very good at climbing trees and shooting the unwary as they passed below. The bruise on her cheekbone had faded to a faint yellow. "What did you say?" Richie asked. He was shocked, but also a little intrigued. "I will want to take a look under that porch," Bill said. His voice was stubborn, but he wouldn't look at Richie. There was a hard spot of flush high in each of his cheekbones. They had arrived in front of Richie's house. Maggie Tozier was on the porch reading a book. She waved to them and called, "Hi, boys, want some iced tea?" "We'll be right there, Mom," Richie said, and then to Bill, "There isn't going to be anything there. He probably just saw a hobo and got all bent out of shape, for God's sake. You know Eddie."
Yeah, I know Eddie. But remember the picture in the album?"
Richie shifted his feet, uncomfortable. Bill raised his right hand. The band-aids were gone now, but Richie could see circlets of healing scab on Bill's first three fingers.
"Yeah, but listen to Mimi," Bill said.
He began to speak very slowly, holding Richie's eyes with his own. Once more he related the similarities between Ben's story and Eddie's, and tied those to what he had seen in the picture that moved. He suggested again that the clown had murdered the boys and girls who had been found dead in Derry since the previous December.
"And Mama Haby, not just to them," Bill finished. "Well, what about all the ones who disappeared? Well, what about Eddie Corcoran?
"Shit, his stepfather scared him off," Richie said.
"Well, maybe he didn't, Bill said. "I knew him a little bit, too, and I know his dad beat him. And I also know he used to stay out in the heights sometimes to get away from him.
So maybe the clown got him while he was staying away, Richie said thoughtfully. Is that it?
Bill nodded.
What do you want, then? Its autograph?
If the Click-Click-Click-Hound killed the others, then he killed Georgie,
Bill said. His eyes caught Richie's. They were like slate, hard, uncompromising, unforgiving.
I will want to kill it. Jesus Christ, Richie said, frightened. How are you going to do that?
My dad's got a pistol, Bill said.
A little spittle flew from his lips, but Richie barely noticed.
He doesn't know I know, but I do. It's on the top shelf in his closet.
That's great if it's a man, Richie said, and if we can find him sitting on a pile of kids' bones.
I poured the tea, boys, Richie's mom called cheerily. Better come and get it.
Right there, Mom,
Richie called again, offering a big false smile. It disappeared immediately as he turned back to Bill.
Because I wouldn't shoot a guy just because he was wearing a clown suit, Billy. You're my best friend, but I wouldn't do it, and I wouldn't let you do it if I could stop you.
Well, what if there really was a pile of bones?
Richie licked his lips and said nothing for a moment. Then he asked Bill,
What are you going to do if it's not a man, Billy? What if it really is some kind of monster?
What if there really are such things? Ben Hanscom said it was the mummy, and the balloons were floating against the wind, and it didn't cast a shadow.
The picture in Georgie's album, either we imagined that or it was magic. And I gotta tell you, man, I don't think we just imagined it. Your fingers sure didn't imagine it, did they?
Bill shook his head.
So what are we going to do if it's not a man, Billy?
Then we'll have to figure something else out.
Oh, yeah, Richie said. I can see it. After you shoot it 4 or 5 times and it keeps coming at us like the teenage werewolf in that movie me and Ben and Bev saw, you can try your bullseye on it. And if the bullseye doesn't work, I'll throw some of my sneezing powder at it. And if it keeps on coming after that, we'll just call time and say, Hey now, hold on. This ain't getting it, Mr. Monster. Look, I got to read up on it at the library. I'll be back. Pardon me.
Is that what you're going to say, Big Bill?
He looked at his friend, his head thudding rapidly. Part of him wanted Bill to press on with his idea to check under the porch of that old house, but another part wanted, desperately wanted, Bill to give the idea up. In some ways, all of this was like having stepped into one of those Saturday afternoon horror movies at the Aladdin. But in another way, a crucial way, it wasn't like that at all. Because this wasn't safe like a movie, where you knew everything would turn out all right, and even if it didn't, it was no skin off your ass. The picture in Georgie's room hadn't been a movie. He had thought he was forgetting that, but apparently he had been fooling himself, because now he could see those cuts whirling up Billy's fingers. If he hadn't pulled Bill back... Incredibly, Bill was grinning. Actually grinning.
You wanted me to take you to look at a picture, he said. Now, I will want to take you to look at a house. Tit for tat.
You've got no tits, Richie said, and they both burst out laughing.
Tomorrow morning, Bill said,
as if it had been resolved.
And if it's a monster? Richie asked, holding Bill's eyes. If your dad's gun doesn't stop it, Big Bill, if it just keeps coming?
We'll think of something else, Bill said again. We'll have to.
He threw back his head and laughed like a loon. After a moment, Richie joined him. It was impossible not to. They walked up the crazy paving to Richie's porch together. Maggie had set out huge glasses of iced tea with mint sprigs in them and a plate of vanilla wafers.
You will want to?
Well, no, Richie said, but I will.
Bill clapped him on the back, hard, and that seemed to make the fear bearable, although Richie was suddenly sure, and he was not wrong, that sleep would be long coming that night.
You boys looked like you were having a serious discussion out there, Mrs. Tozier said, sitting down with her book in one hand and a glass of iced tea in the other. She looked at the boys expectantly.
Oh, Denbro's got this crazy idea the Red Sox are going to finish in the first division, Richie said.
Me and my dad to think that they got a shot at the third, Bill said, and sipped his iced tea.
This is very good, Mrs. Tozier.
Thank you, Bill.
The year the Sox finish in the first division will be the year you stop stuttering, Mushmouth, Richie said.
Richie!
Mrs. Tozier screamed, shocked. She nearly dropped her glass of iced tea, but both Richie and Bill Denbro were laughing hysterically, totally cracked up. She looked from her son to Bill and back to her son again, touched by wonder that was mostly simple perplexity, but partly a fear so thin and sharp that it found its way deep into her inner heart and vibrated there like a tuning fork made of clear ice. I don't understand either of them, she thought. Where they go, what they do, what they want, or what will become of them. Sometimes, oh, sometimes their eyes are wild, and sometimes I'm afraid for them, and sometimes I'm afraid of them. She found herself thinking, not for the first time, that it would have been nice if she and Went could have had a girl as well, a pretty blonde girl that she could have dressed in skirts and matching bows and black patent leather shoes on Sundays, a pretty little girl who would ask to bake cupcakes after school, and who would want dolls instead of books on ventriloquism and Ravel models of cars that went fast. A pretty little girl she could have understood. 12. Did you get it? Richie asked anxiously. They were walking their bikes up Kansas Street beside the Barrens at 10 o'clock the next morning. The sky was a dull gray. Rain had been forecast for that afternoon. Richie hadn't gotten to sleep until after midnight, and he thought Denbro looked as if he had spent a fairly restless night himself. Old Big Bill was toting a matched set of Samsonite bags, one under each eye.
I got it, Bill said.
He patted the green duffel coat he was wearing.
Let me see, Richie said, fascinated. Not now, Bill said, and then grinned. Someone else might see, too. But look what else I brought.
He reached behind him, under the coat, and brought his bullseye slingshot out of his back pocket.
Oh, shit, we're in trouble, Richie said, beginning to laugh.
Bill pretended to be hurt. It was your idea, Tozier. Bill had gotten the custom aluminum slingshot for his birthday the year before. It had been Zack's compromise between the 22 Bill had wanted and his mother's adamant refusal to even consider giving a boy Bill's age a firearm. The instruction booklet said a slingshot could be a fine hunting weapon once you learn to use it. In the right hands, your bullseye slingshot is as deadly and effective as a good ash bow or a high-powered firearm, the booklet proclaimed. With such virtues dutifully extolled, the booklet went on to warn that a slingshot could be dangerous. The owner should no more aim one of the 20 ball-bearing slugs which came with it at a person than he would aim a loaded pistol at a person. Bill wasn't very good at it yet, and guessed privately he probably never would be, but he thought the booklet's caution was merited. The slingshot's thick elastic had a hard pull, and when you hit a tin can with it, it made one hell of a hole.
You doing any better with it, Big Bill? Richie asked.
A little, Bill said. That was only partly true. After much study of the pictures in the booklet, which were labeled figs, as in Fig 1, Fig 2, and so on, and enough practice in Dairy Park to lame his arm, he had gotten so he could hit the paper target, which had also come with the slingshot, maybe 3 times out of every 10 tries. And once he had gotten a bullseye. Almost. Richie pulled the sling back by the cup, twanged it, then handed it back. He said nothing, but privately doubted if it would count for as much as Zack Denbro's pistol when it came to killing monsters.
Yeah, he said. You brought your slingshot. Okay, big deal. That's nothing. Look what I brought, Denbro.
And from his own jacket, he hauled out a packet with a cartoon picture on it of a bald man saying, "Achoo," as his cheeks puffed out like Dizzy Gillespie's. "Dr. Wacky's sneezing powder," the packet said. "It's a laugh riot." The two of them stared at each other for a long moment and then broke up, screaming with laughter and pounding each other on the back.
Well, we're prepared for anything, Bill said finally, still giggling and wiping his eyes with the sleeve of his jacket.
Your face in my ass, stuttering Bill, Richie said.
I thought it was the other way around, Bill said. Now listen, well, we're gonna hash your bike down in the Barrens. Well, where I put silver when we play. You ride at a double behind me, in case where we have to make a quick getaway.
Richie nodded, feeling no urge to argue. His 22-inch Raleigh, he sometimes whammed his kneecaps on the handlebars when he was pedaling fast, looked like a pygmy bike next to the scrawny, gantry-like edifice that was Silver. He knew that Bill was stronger and Silver was faster.
They got to the little bridge, and Bill helped Richie stow his bike underneath. Then they sat down, and with the occasional rumble of traffic passing over their heads, Bill unzipped his duffel and took out his father's pistol.
You be goddamn took a careful, Bill said, handing it over after Richie had whistled his frank approval. There's no safety on a pistol like that.
Is it loaded? Richie asked, awed. The pistol, a PPK Walther that Zack Denbro picked up during the occupation, seemed unbelievably heavy.
Not yet, Bill said. He patted his pocket. I got some bullets in here. But my dad says sometimes you look and then, if the gun thinks you're not being careful, it loads it itself.
So it can hoot you. His face uttered a strange smile, which said that, while he didn't believe anything so silly, he believed it completely. Richie understood. There was a caged deadliness in the thing that he had never sensed in his dad's 22, 30-30, or even the shotgun. Although there was something about the shotgun, wasn't there? Something about the way it leaned, mute and oily, in the corner of the garage closet, as if it might say, I could be mean if I wanted to. Plenty mean, you bet, if it could speak. But this pistol, this Walther, it was as if it had been made for the express purpose of shooting people. With a chill, Richie realized that was why it had been made. What else could you do with a pistol? Use it to light your cigarettes? He turned the muzzle toward him, being careful to keep his hands far away from the trigger. One look into the Walther's black, lidless eye made him understand Bill's peculiar smile perfectly. He remembered his father saying, If you remember there is no such thing as an unloaded gun, you'll be okay with firearms all your life, Richie. He handed the gun back to Bill, glad to be rid of it. Bill stowed it in his duffel coat again. Suddenly, the house on Niebold Street seemed less frightening to Richie. But the possibility that blood might actually be spilled, that seemed much stronger. He looked at Bill, perhaps meaning to appeal this idea again, but he saw Bill's face, read it, and only said, You ready? 13. As always, when Bill finally pulled his second foot up from the ground, Richie felt sure that they would crash, splitting their silly skulls on unyielding cement. The big bike wavered crazily from side to side. The card's clothespin to the fender struts stopped firing single shots and started machine gunning. The bike's drunken wavers became more pronounced. Richie closed his eyes and waited for the inevitable. Then Bill bellowed, Hi-yo, Silver! Away! The bike picked up more speed and finally stopped that seasick side-to-side wavering. Richie loosened his death grip on Bill's middle and held the front of the package carrier over the rear wheel instead. Bill crossed Kansas Street on a slant, raced down side streets at an ever-quickening pace, heading for Wycheham as if racing down a set of geographical steps. They came bulleting out of Strapham Street and onto Wycheham at an exorbitant rate of speed. Bill laid Silver damn near over on his side and bellowed, Hi-yo, Silver! Again.
Ride it, Big Bill! Richie screamed, so scared he was nearly creaming his jeans, but laughing wildly all the same. Stand on this baby!
Bill suited the action to the word, getting up and leaning over the handlebars and pumping the pedals at a lunatic rate. Looking at Bill's back, which was amazingly broad for a boy of 11 going on 12, watching it work under the duffel coat, the shoulders slanting first one way and then the other as he shifted his weight from one pedal to the other, Richie suddenly became sure that they were invulnerable. They would live forever and ever. Well, perhaps not they, but Bill would. Bill had no idea of how strong he was, how somehow sure and perfect. They sped along, the houses thinning out a little now, the streets crossing Wycheham at longer intervals. Hi-yo, Silver! Bill yelled, and Richie hollered in his nigger Jim voice, high and shrill,
Hi-yo, Silver, massa, that's right. You is riding dis year bike for show, locks a mussy. Hi-yo, Silver, away!
Now they were passing green fields that looked flat and depthless under the gray sky. Richie could see the old brick train station up ahead in the distance. To the right of it, Quonset warehouses marched off in a row. Silver bumped over one set of train tracks, then another. And here was Niebold Street, cutting off to the right. Derry Train Yards, a blue sign under the street sign read. It was rusty and hung askew. Below this was a much bigger sign, yellow field, black letters. It was almost like a comment on the train yards themselves.
Dead end, it read. Bill turned onto Nebold Street, coasted to the sidewalk, and put his foot back down. We'll walk from here. Richie slipped off the package carrier with mingled feelings of relief and regret.
Okay.
They walked along the sidewalk, which was cracked and weedy. Up ahead of them, in the train yards, a diesel engine revved slowly up, faded off, and then began all over again. Once or twice they heard the metallic music of couplings being smashed together.
You scared?
Richie asked Bill. Bill, walking Silver by the handlebars, looked over at Richie briefly and then nodded.
Yeah. You?
I sure am, Richie said. Bill told Richie he had asked his father about Nebold Street the night before. His father said that a lot of train men had lived out this way until the end of World War II. Engineers, conductors, signalmen, yard workers, baggage handlers. The street had declined with the train yards, and as Bill and Richie moved farther along it, the houses became farther apart, seedier, dirtier. The last three or four on both sides were empty and boarded up, their yards overgrown. A for sale sign flapped forlornly from the porch of one. To Richie, the sign looked about 1,000 years old. The sidewalk stopped, and now they were walking along a beaten track from which weeds grew half-heartedly. Bill stopped and pointed.
There it is, he said softly.
29 Nebold Street had once been a trim red Cape Cod. Maybe, Richie thought, an engineer used to live there. A bachelor with no pants but jeans and lots of those gloves with the big stiff cuffs and four or five pillow-tick caps. A fellow who would come home once or twice a month for stretches of 3 or 4 days and listen to the radio while he pottered in the garden. A fellow who would eat mostly fried foods and no vegetables, although he would grow them for his friends. And who would, on windy nights, think about the girl he left behind. Now the red paint had faded to a wishy-washy pink that was peeling away in ugly patches that looked like sores. The windows were blind eyes, boarded up. Most of the shingles were gone. Weeds grew rankly down both sides of the house, and the lawn was covered with the season's first bumper crop of dandelions. To the left, a high board fence, perhaps once a neat white but now faded to a dull gray that almost matched the lowering sky, lurched drunkenly in and out of the dank shrubbery. About halfway down this fence, Richie could see a monstrous grove of sunflowers. The tallest looked 5 feet tall or more. They had a bloated, nasty look he didn't like. A breeze rustled them, and they seemed to nod together.
The boys are here. Isn't that nice? More boys. Our boys.
Richie shivered. While Bill leaned Silver carefully against an elm, Richie surveyed the house. He saw a wheel sticking out of the thick grass near the porch and pointed it out to Bill. Bill nodded. It was the overturned trike Eddie had mentioned. They looked up and down Nebold Street. The chug of the diesel engine rose and fell off, then began again. The sound seemed to hang in the overcast like a charm. The street was utterly deserted. Richie could hear occasional cars passing on Route 2, but could not see them. The diesel engine chugged and faded, chugged and faded. The huge sunflowers nodded sagely together.
Fresh boys, good boys, our boys.
You ready? Bill asked, and Richie jumped a little.
You know, I was just thinking that maybe the last bunch of library books I took out are due today, Richie said. Maybe I ought to...
Cut the crap, River Richie. Are you ready or not?
I guess I am, Richie said, knowing he was not ready at all. He was never going to be ready for this scene.
They crossed the overgrown lawn to the porch.
Look there, Bill said.
At the far left-hand side, the porch's latticework skirt leaned out against a tangle of bushes. Both boys could see the rusty nails that had been pulled free. There were old rose bushes here, and while the roses both to the right and the left of the unanchored stretch of latticework were blooming in a lackadaisical way, those directly around and in front of it were skeletal and dead. Bill and Richie looked at each other grimly. Everything Eddie said seemed true enough. 7 weeks later, the evidence was still here.
You don't really want to go under there, do you? Richie asked.
He was almost pleading.
No, Bill said.
But I'm gonna... And with a sinking heart, Richie saw that he absolutely meant it. That gray light was back in Billy's eyes, shining steadily.
There was a stony eagerness in the lines of his face that made him look older. Richie thought, I think he really does mean to kill it, if it's still there. Kill it and maybe cut off its head and take it to his father and say, look, this is what killed Georgie. Now will you talk to me again at night? Maybe just tell me how your day was, or who lost when you guys were flipping to see who paid for the morning coffee? Bill, he said. But Bill was no longer there. He was walking around to the right-hand end of the porch, where Eddie must have crawled under. Richie had to chase after him, and he almost fell over the trike caught in the weeds and slowly rusting its way into the ground. He caught up as Bill squatted, looking under the porch. There was no skirt at all on this end. Someone, some hobo, had pried it off long ago to gain access to the shelter underneath, out of the January snow or the cold November rain or a summer thundershower. Richie squatted beside him, his heart thudding like a drum. There was nothing under the porch but drifts of moldering leaves, yellowing newspapers and shadows. Too many shadows. Bill, he repeated.
What?
Bill had produced his father's Walther again. He pulled the clip carefully from the grip and then took four bullets from his pants pocket. He loaded them in one at a time. Richie watched this, fascinated, and then looked under the porch again. He saw something else this time. Broken glass. Faintly glinting shards of glass. His stomach cramped painfully. He was not a stupid boy, and he understood this came close to completely confirming Eddie's story. Splinters of glass on the moldering leaves under the porch meant that the window had been broken from inside, from the cellar.
Well, what?
Bill asked again, looking up at Richie. His face was grim and white. Looking at that set face, Richie mentally threw in the towel.
Nothing, he said. You cook a humming?
Yeah. They crawled under the porch. The smell of decaying leaves was a smell Richie usually liked, but there was nothing pleasant about the smell under here. The leaves felt spongy under his hands and knees, and he had an impression that they might go down for 2 or 3 feet. He suddenly wondered what he would do if a hand or a claw sprang out of those leaves and seized him. Bill was examining the broken window. Glass had sprayed everywhere. The wooden strip which had been between the panes lay in 2 splintered pieces under the porch steps. The top of the window frame jutted out like a broken bone.
Something hit that fucker wicked hard, Richie breathed.
Bill, now peering inside, or trying to, nodded. Richie elbowed him aside enough so he could look too. The basement was a dim litter of crates and boxes. The floor was earth and, like the leaves, it gave off a damp and humid aroma. A furnace bulked to the left, thrusting round pipes at the low ceiling. Beyond it, at the end of the cellar, Richie could see a large stall with wooden sides. A horse stall was his first thought, but who kept horses in the Geesley cellar? Then he realized that in a house as old as this one, the furnace must have burned coal instead of oil. Nobody had bothered to convert the furnace because no one wanted the house. That thing with the sides was a coal bin. To the far right, Richie could make out a flight of stairs going up to ground level. Now Bill was sitting down, hunching himself forward, and before Richie could actually believe what he was up to, his friend's legs were disappearing into the window.
Bill, Christ's sake, he hissed. What are you doing? Get out of there.
Bill didn't reply. He slithered through, scraping his duffel coat up from the small of his back, barely missing a chunk of glass that would have cut him a good one. A second later, Richie heard his tennies smack down on the earth hard inside.
Piss on this action,
Richie muttered frantically to himself, looking at the square of darkness into which his friend had disappeared.
Bill, you gone out of your mind?
Bill's voice floated up.
You cook again, stay up the there if you will want, River Richie. Stand cook a guard.
Instead, he rolled over on his belly and shoved his legs through the cellar window before his nerve could go bad on him, hoping he wouldn't cut his hands or his stomach on the broken glass. Something clutched his legs. Richie screamed.
It's just a husk me,
Bill hissed. And a moment later, Richie was standing beside him in the cellar, pulling down his shirt and his jacket.
The hoot did you think it was?
The boogeyman, Richie said, and laughed shakily.
You go that way, and I'll fuck that, Richie said.
He could actually hear his heartbeat in his voice, making it sound bumpy and uneven, first up and then down.
I'm sticking with you, Big Bill.
They moved toward the coal pit first, Bill slightly in the lead, the gun in his hand, Richie close behind him, trying to look everywhere at once.
Bill stood beyond one of the coal pit's jutting wooden sides for a moment, and then suddenly darted around it, pointing the gun with both hands. Richie squinched his eyes shut, steeling himself for the explosion. It didn't come. He opened his eyes again cautiously.
Nothing but coal, Bill said and giggled nervously.
Richie stepped up beside Bill and looked. There was still a drift of old coal in here, piled up almost to the ceiling at the back of the stall and trickling away to a lump or two by their feet. It was as black as a crow's wing. Richie began, and then the door at the head of the cellar stairs crashed open against the wall with a violent bang, spilling thin white daylight down the stairs. Both boys screamed. Richie heard snarling sounds. They were very loud, the sounds a wild animal in a cage might make. He saw loafers descend the steps, faded jeans on top of them, swinging hands. But they weren't hands. They were paws. Huge, misshapen paws.
Climb the coal,
Bill was screaming, but Richie stood frozen, suddenly knowing what was coming for them, what was going to kill them in this cellar that stank of damp earth and the cheap wine that had been spilled in the corners. Knowing but needing to see.
There's a window at the top of the coal.
The paws were covered with dense brown hair that curled and coiled like wire. The fingers were tipped with jagged nails. Now Richie saw a silk jacket. It was black with orange piping. The Derry High School colors.
Go,
Bill screamed and gave Richie a gigantic shove. Richie went sprawling into the coal. Sharp jags and corners of it poked him painfully, breaking through his daze. More coal avalanched over his hands. That mad snarling went on and on. Panic slipped its hood over Richie's mind. Barely aware of what he was doing, he scrambled up the mountain of coal, gaining ground, sliding back, lunging upward again, screaming as he went. The window at the top was grimed black with coal dust and let in next to no light at all. It was latched shut. Richie seized the latch, which was of the sort that turned, and threw all his weight against it. The latch moved not at all. The snarling was closer now. The gun went off below him, the sound nearly deafening in the closed room. Gun smoke, sharp and acrid, stung Richie's nose. It shocked him back to some sort of awareness, and he realized that he had been trying to turn the thumb latch the wrong way. He reversed the direction of the force he was applying, and the latch gave with a protracted, rusty squeal. Coal dust sifted down on his hands like pepper. The gun went off again with a second deafening bang. Bill Denbro shouted, "You killed my brother, you fucker!" For a moment the creature which had come down the stairs seemed to laugh, seemed to speak. It was as if a vicious dog had suddenly begun to bark out garbled words, and for a moment Richie thought the thing in the high school jacket snarled back, "I'm going to kill you, too."
"Richie!"
Bill screamed then, and Richie heard coal clattering and falling again as Bill scrambled up. The snarls and roars continued, wood splintered, there were mingled barks and howls, sounds out of a cold nightmare. Richie gave the window a tremendous shove, not caring if the glass broke and cut his hands to ribbons. He was beyond caring. It did not break. It swung outward on an old steel hinge flaked with rust. More coal dust sifted down, this time on Richie's face. He wriggled out into the side yard like an eel, smelling sweet, fresh air, feeling the long grass whip at his face. He was dimly aware that it was raining. He could see the thick stalks of the giant sunflowers, green and hairy. The Walther went off a third time, and the beast in the cellar screamed, a primitive sound of pure rage. Then Bill cried,
"It's got me, Richie! Help! It's got me!"
Richie turned around on his hands and knees and saw the terrified circle of his friend's upturned face in the square of the oversized cellar window through which a winter's load of coal had once been funneled each October. Bill was lying spread-eagled on the coal. His hands waved and clutched fruitlessly for the window frame, which was just out of reach. His shirt and jacket were rucked up almost to his breastbone, and he was sliding backward. No, he was being pulled backward by something Richie could barely see. It was a moving, bulking shadow behind Bill, a shadow that snarled and gibbered and sounded almost human. Richie didn't need to see it. He had seen it the previous Saturday on the screen of the Aladdin Theater. It was mad, totally mad. But even so, it never occurred to Richie to doubt either his own sanity or his conclusion. The teenage werewolf had Bill Denbro. Only it wasn't that guy Michael Landon with a lot of makeup on his face and a lot of fake fur. It was real. As if to prove it, Bill screamed again.
Richie reached in and caught Bill's hands in his own. The Walther pistol was in one of them, and for the second time that day, Richie looked into its black eye. Only this time it was loaded. They tussled for Bill, Richie gripping his hands, the werewolf gripping his ankles.
Get out of here, Richie, Bill screamed. Get.
The face of the werewolf suddenly swam out of the dark. Its forehead was low and prognathous, covered with scant hair. Its cheeks were hollow and furry. Its eyes were a dark brown, filled with horrible intelligence, horrible awareness. Its mouth dropped open and it began to snarl. White foam ran from the corners of its thick lower lip in twin streams that dripped from its chin. The hair on its head was swept back in a gruesome parody of a teenager's DA. It threw its head back and roared, its eyes never leaving Richie's. Bill scrambled up the coal. Richie seized his forearms and pulled. For a moment he thought he was actually going to win. Then the werewolf laid hold of Bill's legs again and he was yanked backward toward the darkness once more. It was stronger. It had laid hold of Bill, and it meant to have him. Then, with no thought at all about what he was doing or why he was doing it, Richie heard the voice of the Irish cop coming out of his mouth, Mr. Nell's voice. But this was not Richie Tozier doing a bad imitation. It wasn't even precisely Mr. Nell. It was the voice of every Irish beat cop that had ever lived and twirled a billy by its rawhide rope as he tried the doors of closed shops after midnight.
Let go of him, boyo, or I'll crack your thick head, I swear to Jesus. Leave go of him now, or I'll serve ye your own arse on a platter.
The creature in the cellar let out an ear-splitting roar of rage, but it seemed to Richie that there was another note in that bellow as well, perhaps fear or pain. He gave one more tremendous tug, and Bill flew out of the window and onto the grass. He stared up at Richie with dark, horrified eyes. The front of his jacket was smeared black with coal dust.
Quick,
Bill panted. He was nearly moaning. He grabbed at Richie's shirt.
Woo-wee-ga-ga-hada.
Richie could hear coal tumbling and avalanching down again. A moment later, the werewolf's face filled the cellar window. It snarled at them, its paws clutched at the listless grass. Bill still had the Walther. He had held onto the gun through all of it. Now he held it out in both hands, his eyes squinched down to slits, and pulled the trigger. There was another deafening bang. Richie saw a chunk of the werewolf's skull tear free and a torrent of blood spilled down the side of its face, matting the fur there and soaking the collar of the school jacket it wore. Roaring, it began to climb out of the window. Moving slowly, dreamily, Richie reached under his coat and into his back pocket. He brought out the envelope with the picture of the sneezing man on it. He tore it open as the bleeding, roaring creature pulled itself out of the window, forcing its way, claws digging deep furrows in the earth. Richie tore the packet open and squeezed it.
Get back in your place, boyo, he ordered in the voice of the Irish cop.
A white cloud puffed into the werewolf's face. Its roars suddenly stopped. It stared at Richie with almost comic surprise and made a choked wheezing sound. Its eyes, red and bleary, rolled toward Richie and seemed to mark him once and forever. Then it began to sneeze. It sneezed again and again and again. Ropy strings of saliva flew from its muzzle. Greenish-black clots of snot flew out of its nostrils. One of these splattered against Richie's skin and burned there, like acid. He wiped it away with a scream of hurt and disgust. There was still anger in its face, but there was also pain. It was unmistakable. Bill might have heard it with his dad's pistol, but Richie had heard it more, first with the voice of the Irish cop, and then with the sneezing powder.
Jesus, if I had some itching powder, too, and maybe a joy buzzer, I might be able to kill it, Richie thought.
And then Bill grabbed the collar of his jacket and jerked him backward. It was well that he did. The werewolf stopped sneezing as suddenly as it had started and lunged at Richie. It was quick, too, incredibly quick. Richie might have only sat there with the empty envelope of Dr. Wacky's sneezing powder in one hand, staring at the werewolf with a kind of drugged wonder, thinking how brown its fur was, how red the blood was, how nothing was in black and white in real life. He might have sat there until its paws closed around his neck and its long nails pulled his throat out, but Bill grabbed him again and pulled him to his feet. Richie stumbled after him. They ran around to the front of the house and Richie thought, it won't dare chase us anymore. We're on the street now. It won't dare chase us. Won't dare. Won't dare. But it was coming. He could hear it just behind them, gibbering and snarling and slobbering. There was Silver, still leaning against the tree. Bill jumped onto the seat and threw his father's pistol into the carrier basket where they had carried so many play guns.
Richie chanced a glance behind him as he flung himself onto the package carrier and saw the werewolf crossing the lawn toward them, less than 20 feet away now. Blood and slobber mixed on its high school jacket. White bone gleamed through its pelt about the right temple. There were white smudges of sneezing powder on the sides of its nose. And Richie saw two other things which seemed to complete the horror. There was no zipper on the thing's jacket. Instead, there were big, fluffy orange buttons like pom-poms. The other thing was worse. It was the other thing that made him feel as if he might faint or just give up and let it kill him. A name was stitched on the jacket in gold thread, the kind of thing you could get down at Machen's for a buck if you wanted it. Stitched on the bloody left breast of the werewolf's jacket, stained but readable, were the words, Richie Tozier. It lunged at them.
Go, Bill!
Richie screamed. Silver began to move, but slowly, much too slowly. It took Bill so long to get going. The werewolf crossed the rutted path just as Bill pedaled into the middle of Nebold Street. Blood splattered its faded jeans, and looking back over his shoulder, filled with a kind of dreadful, unbreakable fascination that was akin to hypnosis, Richie saw that the seams of the jeans were giving way in places, and tufts of coarse brown fur had sprung through. Silver wavered wildly back and forth. Bill was standing up, gripping the bike's handlebars from underneath, head turned up toward the cloudy sky, cords standing out on his neck. And still the playing cards were only firing single shots. One paw groped for Richie. He screamed miserably and ducked away from it. The werewolf snarled and grinned. It was close enough so Richie could see the yellowing corneas of its eyes, could smell sweet rotten meat on its breath. Its teeth were crooked fangs. Richie screamed again as it swung a paw at him. He was sure it was going to take his head off, but the paw passed in front of him, missing by no more than an inch. The force of the swing blew Richie's sweaty hair back from his forehead. "Hey-o, Silver, away!" Bill screamed at the top of his voice. He had reached the top of a short, shallow hill. Not much, but enough to get Silver rolling. The playing cards picked up speed and began to burr along. Bill pumped the pedals madly. Silver stopped wavering and cut a straight course down Nebold Street toward Route 2. "Thank God, thank God, thank God," Richie thought incoherently. "Thank..." The werewolf roared again. "Oh my God, it sounds like it's right beside me." And Richie's wind was cut off as his shirt and jacket were jerked back against his windpipe. He made a gargling, choking sound and managed to grip Bill's middle just before he was pulled off the back of the bike. Bill tilted backward but held on to Silver's handlebar grips. For one moment, Richie thought the big bike would simply do a wheelie and spill both of them off the back. Then his jacket, which had been just about ready for the rag bag anyway, parted down the back with a loud ripping noise that sounded weirdly like a big fart. Richie could breathe again. He looked around and stared directly into those muddy, murderous eyes. "Bill!" he tried to howl it, but the word had no force, no sound. Bill seemed to hear him anyway. He pedaled even harder, harder than he ever had in his life. All his guts seemed to be rising, coming unanchored. He could taste thick, coppery blood in the back of his throat. His eyeballs were starting from their sockets. His mouth hung open, scooping air. And a crazy, ineluctable sense of exhilaration filled him, something that was wild and free and all his own. A desire. He stood on the pedals, coaxed them, battered them. Silver continued to pick up speed. He was beginning to feel the road now, beginning to fly. Bill could feel him go. "Hi-yo, Silver!" he screamed again. "Hi-yo, Silver! Away!" Richie could hear the fast rattle thud of loafers on the macadam. He turned. The werewolf's paw struck him above the eyes with stunning force. And for a moment, Richie really did think the top of his head had come off. Things suddenly seemed dim, unimportant. Sounds faded in and out. The color washed out of the world. He turned back, clinging desperately to Bill. Warm blood ran into his right eye, stinging. The paw swung again, striking the back fender this time. Richie felt the bike waver crazily, for a moment on the verge of tipping over, finally straightening out again. Bill yelled, "Hi-o, Silver, away!" again. But that was distant too, like an echo heard just before it dies out. Richie closed his eyes and held on to Bill and waited for the end. 14. Bill had also heard the running steps and understood that the clown hadn't given up yet, but he didn't dare turn around and look. He would know if it caught up and knocked them flat. That was really all he needed to know. "Come on, boy," he thought. "Give me everything now, everything you've got. Go, Silver, go."
So once again, Bill Denbro found himself racing to beat the devil. Only now the devil was a hideously grinning clown, whose face sweated white grease paint, whose mouth curved up in a leering red vampire smile, whose eyes were bright silver coins. A clown who was, for some lunatic reason, wearing a Derry High School jacket over its silvery suit with the orange ruff and the orange pom-pom buttons.
Go, boy, go! Silver, what do you say?
Kneebolt Street blurred by him now. Silver was starting to hum good now. Had those running footfalls faded back a bit? He still didn't dare turn around to see. Richie had him in a death grip. He was pinching off his wind, and Bill wanted to tell Richie to loosen up a little, but he didn't dare waste breath on that either. There, up ahead, like a beautiful dream, was the stop sign marking the intersection of Kneebolt Street and Route 2. Cars were passing back and forth on Witcham. In his state of exhausted terror, this seemed somehow like a miracle to Bill. Now, because he would have to put on his brakes in a moment or do something really inventive, he risked a look back over his shoulder. What he saw caused him to reverse Silver's pedal with a single snap jerk. Silver skidded, laying rubber with its locked rear tire, and Richie's head smacked painfully into the hollow of Bill's right shoulder. The street was completely empty. But 25 yards or so behind them, by the first of the abandoned houses which formed a kind of funeral cortege leading up to the train yards, there was a bright flick of orange. It lay close to a storm drain cut into the curbing. Almost too late, Bill realized that Richie was sliding off the back of Silver. Richie's eyes were turned up so Bill could only see the lower rims of the irises below his upper lids. The mended bow of his glasses hung askew. Blood was flowing slowly from his forehead. Bill grabbed his arm, they both slipped to the right, and Silver overbalanced. They crashed to the street in a tangle of arms and legs. Bill barked his crazy bone a good one and shouted with pain. Richie's eyes flickered at the sound.
I am going to show you how to get to this treasure, Senhor, but this man Dobbs is plenty dangerous,
Richie said in a snoring gasp. It was his Pancho Vanilla voice, but its floating, unconnected quality scared Bill badly. He saw several coarse brown hairs clinging to the shallow head wound on Richie's forehead. They were slightly kinky, like his father's pubic hair. They made him feel even more afraid, and he fetched Richie a strong smack upside the head.